You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, grateful for you guys coming out this morning. Our topic today is the idea of being not of the world. I'll explain what I mean by that. I'll give you some verses. But I just wanted to start with a kind of extended quote from the book, The Anxious Generation, from Jonathan Haidt. He is kind of the leading thinker in terms of how technology is impacting some of our kids today. He tells this story. He says, in a classic 1968 social psychology experiment, two experimenters brought students into a lab to take part in what the students thought would be a discussion. The real experiment took place in the waiting room. After a few minutes, a strange smoke began to pour into the room through a vent. Would students get up and go tell someone, or would they just sit there passively? Now, the smoke was totally harmless. It was like the smoke that you use for a fog machine, but you know, they were kind of setting up this situation to see how people would respond. They found in the control condition, students were alone in the waiting room, and in that condition, 75% of the students took action, with half of the students leaving the room to find the experimenter within 2 minutes of noticing the smoke's appearance. So you're sitting there, you see smoke pouring into the room, you're like, oh my gosh, and you immediately go and find somebody. In another condition, three students were brought into the waiting room one at a time and seated at separate desks. And they were given like a questionnaire to fill out. The experimenters wanted to know, would having multiple people witnessing the smoke increase or decrease the likelihood that anyone out of that group would take action? The answer? It decreased it. Only three of the 24 students who were in that condition got up to report the smoke, and only one did so within the first 4 minutes, even though the smoke began to obstruct everyone's vision by then. So there's enough smoke in the room that there's obviously something wrong, and yet everybody's just sitting there and they're like, oh, there's something wrong. And here's the point. He says, this is crucial. Nobody in that room could understand what was going on. Where there is ambiguity, people look to each other to see what everyone else is doing. Those cues help define the situation. Is it an emergency? If everyone else is just sitting there, then every individual comes to the conclusion that no, it's not an emergency. And I've definitely had that where something's going on and I feel like, oh my gosh, I think this is really bad. This is a big deal. Should I be freaking out? And I look around at everybody else and I'm like, nobody else is freaking out. Maybe I'm the one that has it wrong. And according to this experiment, everybody else has the same internal sense, and yet we all don't want to be the ones who are freaking out. We're the ones who don't want to come across like we're overreacting or too worried. And here's the thing. We have an emergency on our hands, and the emergency that has been well documented is this. Young adults are not thriving. That people ages 18 to 24, their rates of anxiety and depression, their ability to function as adults is very poor. Rates of anxiety and depression very high, ability to function very low. And so that's a little bit what we want to talk about today. And I just want to give you what my perspective is. There's a few reasons that I have a unique perspective on how young adults are doing. The first is that I have two teenagers. Both of my kids are now in high school as of this month. Sophie's 16, Matt just turned 15 like 2 days ago. So they'll be freshman and junior in high school this year. Both my husband and I did middle school ministry. And so we each spent 3 years with middle schoolers, which taught us a lot about how youths are doing. We currently lead in a college home church, so we do college high work and we do adult ministry, and so we actually have a pretty broad perspective on how people are doing, and so, you know, I get to see people as they transition from high school up into college. I get to see how it is that they're doing now, and I just kind of have a front row seat at young adulthood. And, you know, having kids myself and being ready, you know, getting close to releasing them into young adulthood, I have to admit that I worry about how culture today is going to affect my kids. So yeah, young adults are not thriving. And what I want to argue today is that it might not be for the reasons that we would guess. That we can look at all sorts of societal factors, and those are real. But I think that there's an underlying issue here that we want to spend time looking at. We want to try to explore from a biblical perspective what it is that is affecting our kids. And so specifically, we want to look at the idea of the world system. What Jesus says in John 17, this is towards the end of his prayer for his followers. He says, as he prays to the Father, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they're not of the world any more than I am of the world. My prayer is not that you would take them out of the world, but that you would protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of them. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. So this is a prayer that Jesus has, and he's talking about the idea of the world and how we as his followers are going to be different from the world, but in the world. And so somehow we're supposed to be in the world, whatever that is, and we'll get into that in a second, but we're not supposed to be of it, that we're supposed to be different, that we're supposed to be distinct in some way. So like I said, we're going to talk about what that means and how to do that, but it would be first helpful to get a definition of what we even mean by the world. Like, what is this system that we're talking about? And it's not, you know, a place. What it is it's a collection of ideas. It's a way of thinking about life, about relationships, about ourselves that is completely antithetical to what God has to offer. The best definition of it is in the book of 1 John, where John says, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in them. So you can either love the world or you can love the Father. And you can't do both at the same time. He says, everything that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life come not from the Father, but from the world. So there's three main categories that we're actually going to look at today that kind of define what this system of values is. And as we get into that, you know, I'm going through this very briefly because that's really our outline for the rest of the talk is what the world system is and how to resist it. I just want to make a couple of clear points about how Jesus views anyone who is a follower of Christ and how they interact with the world. First of all, he says, the world has hated them, for they are not of the world any more than I am of the world. So anyone who wants to be a follower of Christ, you know, is going to have to critique the world system. And Jesus is like, that's just not going to be very popular. He had critiques of what everybody else was going after, and look at how the world treated him. Now, we're not in danger in this culture of being put to death as he was, although in other places around the world, followers of Christ really do have that actual danger. But even without that true physical danger in front of us, we still have the danger of people being very upset with us for having any critique of what everybody else is going after. But Jesus also says, my prayer is not that you would take them out of the world. And so complete protection is not healthy. It's like, look, if you're going to be a follower of mine, the goal is not to withdraw and make sure that you never interact with anything of the world system. You think about the most extreme examples of people withdrawing from the world system. There's communities like the Amish community, where they're like, the world is bad, and we need to stay away from it, and we need to keep our kids away from it. And, you know, the thing is, this is not a place, it's a way of thinking. And so it's never possible, even if you completely withdraw your family and your community from the world system, that you'll be able to get away from the thought patterns. But here's the other thing is Jesus himself is saying that the goal is not to totally withdraw. The goal is to remain engaged and yet separate. And so what we want to do is we want to build up a certain amount of resistance in our kids in order to be able to withstand the world system. I mean, it's kind of like an immune system. What's the healthiest immune system? It's not one where you're completely protected from all germs all the time. Now, I never liked when my kids would have constant runny noses, but it turns out that that was exactly what needed to happen in order for that immune system to build up resistance. And so I would love to completely protect my kids from the world system and everything that it's going to offer to draw them away from God, but that's not actually going to lead to healthy kids, healthy spiritually. What I want them to do is to be able to notice what is wrong and to be able to resist it with some biblical values. Also, Jesus says that the Father sent him into the world, and so he is sending his disciples into the world. So it's not just that we're not supposed to withdraw, but he sends us into the world. We're supposed to go in, and he wants us to be in the world so that we can be different. You know, anybody who comes into a relationship with Christ, we know that we're going to heaven. We know that we have a perfect future awaiting us. And so there's times where people are like, well, why can't we just go to heaven right away? Like, why does God leave us here? This is a hard place to live. And the reason that he leaves us here is because he wants other people to know about his grace. And so if we're to be here, then we're to be having a difference in this world, and we're to stand out as different so that other people have a chance to look at us and realize, okay, this is what a life following God looks like. And so we need to be different in the right ways. We need to be different in ways that are going to be attractive to people. And yet, we're going to be different. If we're going to be followers of God, we're not going to look like everybody else. And that's actually going to be really hard. We're going to have to go against the flow of our culture in order to be able to stand out. And so when we think about this verse in 1 John 2, as we get into the next section of it, what the different facets are, look at what it starts with. Do not love the world or anything in the world. And so this really has to start with our hearts. So as we look at this, as much as I'm going to talk about what this means for our kids, we're also going to have to think about what this means for us as parents. Because if this is a system of values, then our values are going to be part of what matters. And we're going to have to make sure that we have values in line with what God says is important, how to do life, in order to be able to transmit those to our kids. So, like John said, the world system consists of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And these are the three things that we're going to kind of explore, as well as a few overarching issues as we get into this. So number one, the lust of the flesh, it's just whatever feels good. And as people look at the world system, we're going to talk about some easy ways to spot this, the most obvious ways that the world system gets into this, but then much trickier, more subtle things that I think are much more likely to snare us as we're trying to follow God. So easy to spot things like getting into drugs, excessive alcohol use, any illicit sex. Those are things that feel good and people can get easily addicted to. And we're like, okay, we don't want our kids to do any drugs. We don't want our kids to get into any sort of illicit sex. So that feels like pretty black and white. You're either doing drugs or you're not doing drugs. Where it gets harder to spot is issues like comfort. Comfort feels really good. And the hard part about the world system is it offers things that sometimes can be legitimate, but when they become the most important things, all of a sudden those become just as ensnaring. And so when we think about comfort, you know, we think about the room that is set up in just the right way. Or really, for us as parents, it's putting family at the center of everything that we're doing. That my family life, staying home with my family, is going to be what makes us happy. And I know high schoolers and young college students that are so comfortable at home that they never even want to leave their room, let alone grow up and leave their family someday. Because everything has been made as easy as possible for them, has been tailored to them, so they never experience any sort of friction in their life. And so the possible temptation here for us as parents, it's really tempting to want to protect our kids from all discomfort. Now, when I'm around friends who have toddlers, and the toddler gets caught in any sort of situation where there's the least little bit of frustration, what do I want to do? I want to jump right in and fix it for that kid. Oh, here, I'll help you. Because God forbid that they get frustrated. God forbid that they get hurt as they try to do things. And it just feels like if I allow that to happen, then I have neglected this child in some way. Another possible temptation for the lust of the flesh is that the schedule comes first for everything in my kid's life. That if something comes up, it's like, oh, sorry, I can't make that because of this, that, or the other, nap time, bedtime. And that just has to be the priority. Now, okay, I'm about schedules. My kids would go to bed at about the same time every night. We would do basically the same thing every day. But there's a difference between that and the schedule being the top priority, and nothing can flex around that. And here's what I notice is that when these are the main things that we are trying to provide for our kids, the result is an adult who cannot tolerate discomfort of any kind. We have young adults in our college group who want to leave by like 10 o'clock at night from fellowship, not because they're going home and going to bed. Well, they're going home and they're going to bed. They're not going to sleep, though. What they're doing is they're going home and they're getting on their phones in their beds because they're not used to being around people. They're not used to engaging for any length of time. And as a result, they're incapable of flexing at all. I don't know about you guys, but I remember when I was in college, what was like the most fun thing to do? It was to do some adventure where you were out as late as possible and you were hanging out with your friends. And if you could pull an all-nighter, that was like the ultimate. I don't have to worry anymore about people in my home church pulling all-nighters and not getting enough sleep because they don't want to stay out late. They don't want to do anything crazy that's unexpected. They don't want any adventures. What they want to do is they want to make sure that everything is very predictable and that they're not stretched in any way. And so what can we do to resist this? Well, there's a few things that I think we can build in now as we're trying to parent. One is the idea that some discomfort is actually good, that we can allow our kids to be in situations that are difficult, that are painful. We were actually just on a camping trip with three families that all have kids that are 1.5 to 2 years old, and the number of times that those kids got hurt was, I mean, once an hour because we had three toddlers. Twice an hour, it was all the time. Like there was always some kid who was wailing about something. And here's the thing, they were fine the vast majority of the time. Here was the other really funny thing that I noticed is because we were camping, those kids were completely covered in mosquito bites. And here's the thing that I forgot about my kids. Mosquito bites never bothered my kids when they were little. They bothered me. My son, I swear to God, every single bug that was in the entire campground would come and find him. There were times where, and I'm not exaggerating, he was covered in 50 to 75 bug bites. He looked terrible. He looked like he had some sort of disease, and yet it never itched him. It never really bothered him. I looked, and I felt like, I'm a terrible parent because I allowed this to happen, and yet it did not seem to faze him in the least. So some discomfort is good. Here's another thing that I had to keep reminding myself when my kids were little. God is God. The schedule is not God. So again, I'm all for a basic schedule for our kids, but this idea that that is what comes first and anything else outside of that is going to be harmful to my kids is not the way that it works. I mean, think about what Jesus said. Foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to rest his head. Jesus didn't have the same bed to go to every night. Jesus wasn't sure where he was going to sleep that night. And yet he was like, I'm fine. And if you're going to be a follower of me, you need to have a certain amount of flexibility. And so to think that I'm not going to have any flexibility now with my kids, but I'm going to allow them to have that later, is just not the way that it works. It was also helpful for me to realize, you know, you see things like the American Association of Pediatrics, and they do recommend a schedule. And what I don't want you to think is that I'm like, just screw the schedule, do whatever you want with your kids, because a certain amount of regularity and predictability is really helpful. But as I read more and more about parenting, I realized that when the American Association of Pediatrics recommends a schedule, what they're thinking of are the families where the kids are up until 11, 12 o'clock at night because the parents have not even tried to enforce any sort of bedtime, or, you know, it's a household where parents are working three jobs in order to be able to provide some sort of stability, and so the kids have no structure at all. And so what we need is a structure that can flex. I remember hearing about boundaries being like a rubber band and that it can stretch, but then it does snap back. So there are opportunities sometimes where things come up and it's like, well, maybe it's in the middle of my kid's nap time. If they miss their nap today or it goes a little late, they're going to be okay. And here's the funny thing, too, is I was very structured with my first kid, not with my second. I didn't have time to worry about his nap time. He caught a nap when he could. He's a better sleeper than his sister is. We stopped at two. I've talked to families that have three kids. That third kid has no schedule because they're just getting dragged around with all the other kids. And you know what? Those kids are usually fine, too. So I think just realizing that we're being told a certain thing by the world, and we can critique that and observe what actually works from families that are following God's way. So we've got the lust of the flesh, what feels good. We also have the lust of the eye, which is whatever looks good, whatever looks appealing to us. And so the easy to spot lust of the eye is excessive materialism, excessive focus on beauty. Now again, coming from camping, it was both funny but also a little sad to see the number of women who were at the campground and were in the bathroom doing their hair and their makeup. And I'm like, I thought we were camping. Like, I don't even always try to shower while we're camping. And yet, this is not in judgment of them. What I feel is like the amount of pressure that they put on themselves to look a certain way and to feel like even when I'm camping, I can't let down the image at all, because what do I look like when I don't have my full makeup on? I mean, I was taught to wear makeup every single day. When I was in seventh grade, my mom brought in the Mary Kay consultant to tell me what my colors were. Like, I never experimented with anything because I was told this is what to do in order to look a certain way. And it was not until I had little kids that I didn't get up and put my makeup on every day. And my face looked so weird to me in the beginning. When I saw my face in the mirror without the eyeliner and the mascara and the foundation on, at first I was like, ugh. Like, I don't know, I looked like that. But then it was actually kind of funny because I just stopped wearing makeup every day because I just didn't have the time or the energy to do it. And then the first time I got to go to a wedding when my daughter was a toddler, I did put makeup on, and I came down and my daughter was like, "What's on your face?" And I was like, "Oh, okay." And all right, I'm not saying you can't wear makeup. What I'm saying is when this becomes a thing that we have to do in order to feel okay about ourselves, or we have to look a certain way, that the people who are constantly making comments about their weight, about their appearance, you know, always spending tons of time trying to appear a certain way or having to buy the right things in order to feel good about ourselves. So there are extremes that we can go to, but the harder to spot temptation is trying to present a certain image of what we're like, what our lives are like, because we want people to be impressed with how things look. I've talked to some young moms, and they say the current temptation that they face is this idea of the homesteading mom. These moms on social media and who have all these blogs that, you know, they're home prepping all of their meals, and they all look beautiful at the same time. And even if they look messy, they look very artfully messy. You know, maybe there's some flour on their kids as they bake together, but, you know, it's a dusting. And here's the thing. I'm not good at many, many, many domestic tasks. And I'm still drawn to this lifestyle because I'm like, oh, that looks so wholesome. That looks so peaceful. And I know when I try to bake with my children, somebody ends up crying and we're all fighting with each other. Like, wouldn't it be wonderful just to be able to, you know, make your bread every day and put it on the table? And so it's out there, and it's presented in a way that looks real and looks attractive, and it's hard to believe that it's carefully curated. And so what is the actual temptation that we face? Well, it's easy to fall into the social media trap. It's easy to spend a lot of time on social media and feel like that's real and that's how people are living. And when I compare my life to the social media life, I lose every time. And here's the thing. If we're falling into the social media trap, what's going to happen with our kids? Jonathan Haidt has done so much research on this, and he points out smartphones added front-facing cameras in 2010, and Facebook acquired Instagram in 2012, boosting its popularity. I mean, I vaguely remember when Instagram was not that popular, but as soon as the two were linked, it just exploded. And do you remember a time when your camera didn't have a front-facing, or your phone didn't have a front-facing camera? I actually kind of vaguely remember that, but barely. And he said, okay, that's not just a thing that happened. It had an effect. He says, this greatly expanded the number of adolescents posting carefully curated photos and videos of their lives for their peers and for strangers, not just to see, but to judge. Kids out there who have social media accounts are aware of the fact that they're constantly being evaluated. And a lot of these kids, especially girls, live for how many people like their posts, how many people comment on their posts. And it's a trap because this is all algorithms that the social media companies have developed. In fact, one of the most addictive things that they did was they realized inconsistent reinforcement schedule where you don't get any likes and then you get a bunch of likes. It doesn't matter. Like if you post a photo on Instagram, 50 people might like it, but what Instagram's going to do is it's going to withhold all of those likes and then give you all of the likes all at once. So you have to check your account 5 to 10 times before you actually get the reaction from people, but that's not the reality of it. And so this idea that it's how we present ourselves to the world. This is a real thing, and it's something that people are getting sucked into. So there's the social media trap. But then the other temptation that we face is constant anxiety about appearance, whether it's our own personal appearance or the way that our home looks. We had a girl over to our house recently. She came over to dinner. She's about to go into her junior year of high school, and I actually start asking high schoolers or young college students regularly how often their parents have people over. And she said, never. My parents never have anybody over because they always worry that their house is a mess. And I pointed to my house. You know, we have a connected kitchen dining room. And then in our dining room is kind of this bar area just because it overlooks an addition in the back. And our bar area was piled high with all the stuff that we had moved off the dining room table in order to be able to eat dinner. It was right before XSI. We had stacks of books, and we had many, you know, Amazon returns that hadn't gone back yet. Like, you could sit down at the dining room table and eat dinner, but that's because you couldn't put anything else on the bar. And so I pointed to the bar, and I was like, how does your parents' house compare to that? And she goes, oh, that would be really messy. And I was like, yeah. And so, like, they just don't have people over as a result of that? And she said, yeah, or if we do, it's once a year. And the stress level in my house is so high because my mom is trying to clean everything up. And I just thought, this is why families are so isolated, is because the pressure that we put on ourselves is so high. And I'm really grateful that my parents didn't have that standard. That, you know, it was a relatively clean house, but it was not super clean. And so that was not anything that I really had to resist. But also, here's the other thing, is I never got the chance to have that standard because we have people over all the time. So I never got to fall into the trap of hoping that my house looks a certain way because I never have time for my house to look a certain way. And here's the other thing that I noticed. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. If they come into your house and they feel loved by you and they feel served by you, yes, there's a certain level of cleanliness that makes it possible to host. But I did not start doing things like mopping my kitchen floor until about 4 or 5 years ago. And that was only because my kids were old enough to start doing it. Because my philosophy before that was, why would I mop my floor? I'm just going to spill something on it anyway. And in fact, every time I ever spilled anything on my floor, what I would do is I'd put that paper towel on the floor and you move it around with your foot, you know, and you'd pick up the paper towel and it was black. It was black every time. Nasty. But we had tiles that never showed any of the dirt. And nobody was ever eating off the floor. Well, that's actually not true. My kids ate off the floor all the time. But I think they got sick from other things. So anyway, point being, nobody cared. Nobody cared what the cleanliness of my kitchen floor looked like. And honestly, even though my kids mop the floor once a week now, and that's mostly because I need to find things to do to pay them because they need money, I don't think my floor looks any different now than it's been when it's being mopped once a week than it did when it wasn't. I literally can't tell the difference. And so if we've got people who are always worried about appearance of themselves or their lives, what you end up with is a self-focused adult. People who can't think about anybody else because they're always thinking about themselves. And so what do we do to be able to resist this? A few things to build in now. I think one of the biggest things to do is to limit media exposure, and especially when it comes to things like online access. Now, the YouTube ad revenues for children in the U.S., they, as of last year, made $700 million off of ads just to children 12 and under. We're up in the billions once you get to YouTube ad revenues in general. And so the more that we're online, the more that we're going to see ads for lives that look a certain way or things that we have to have in order to be happy. And the less ads we see, the less we're going to struggle with wanting those things or thinking that we have to look a certain way. And then when it comes to social media, Haidt says this. He says, a girl's social standing is usually more closely tied to her beauty and sex appeal than is the case for boys. Do I wish this weren't the case? Absolutely. Is it just the way that it is? Yes. I don't think it has to be that way, but you know, the more tied in we are with the world system and its values, the more our girls are going to struggle with this. And he points out, it was bad enough in the 70s and 80s when girls were exposed to airbrushed and later photoshopped models. You know, you go to the store, you get the magazine, and you would see women that looked a certain way. And he said, but those were adult strangers. They were not the girls' competition. Did I look at the supermodels and feel bad about myself? Absolutely. But did I ever think I was going to be able to look like them? No way. He points out now, what happened when most girls in school, when they got Instagram and Snapchat and started posting carefully edited highlight reels and using filters to improve their virtual beauty and online brand? What happened to girls at that point? Many girls' sociometers, which measures how satisfied one feels with oneself, plunged at that point because most were now below what appeared to them to be the average. Most girls thought, everybody else looks a certain way, and I don't look that way. And that's because anybody can get on Snapchat or Instagram, take a picture of themselves, and then change the way that they look, including how big their eyes are and how small their waists are, and then post that like that's how they look. And there's actually some pretty cool movements out there of celebrities who are like, no, this is what I really looked like in the photo shoot before they added in all the filters. Here's the cellulite, here's the wrinkles. Because otherwise, girls are looking at it and they're thinking, well, I have to look that way in order to look normal, and it turns out that it's not even real. So we need to limit media exposure and online access, not just for our kids, but I think we also have to be careful about our own use. And from the bottom of my heart, I just want to express sympathy for you guys because I didn't even have a smartphone when my kids were little. You know, my kids were born in 2007 and 2009. That was when you could get like a BlackBerry. And that was, you know, if you were a business exec. I just had a flip phone until maybe 2011. And I have a hard enough time now resisting getting on my phone, being distracted by it, resisting social media. And that's with kids who can initiate with me, kids who can tell me when I'm on my phone too much. My teenagers will tell me, Mom, you're distracted, you're on your phone right now. We all try to help each other. But I have a lot of empathy for you guys. If you're staying home with your kids, you know, that's a hard time. So finding ways to try to resist that as much as possible, to resist the pull of that and to set good examples. And then the third one, the pride of life, which is just any sort of success that we can achieve in this life that makes us feel good about ourselves. You know, the easy one to spot is some sort of extreme success that people can achieve. And so you think about the Jeff Bezos of the world. Turns out that his current worth is $180 billion. He's got one of the largest yachts in the world. Or you think about that recent wedding in India. I don't know if you guys followed this. They think that they spent about $600 million on that wedding. And, you know, they were bringing in all sorts of celebrities in order to be guests or to perform at the wedding. Is that also materialism? Yes. But that's a way for those parents to be like, look at the fact that we are among the wealthiest people in the world. And look at the wedding that we can put on, I think, for their third son. So this is, we look at that and we're like, oh, that's a lot. That's way too much. And yet, what's harder to spot is us just taking our identity from our kids. We want our kids to be successful. Why? Because we want their lives to be happy, but I also feel good about myself and my parenting if my kids are doing well. And I feel like I must be a good parent if my kids are seeing success in specific areas. And so the possible temptations here, there's a lot. But the two biggest ones that I see are success in academics and success in sports. That if my kids can be towards the top of their class, if they can be on really elite sports teams, then maybe they'll have a better chance of success later in life. And the problem with these is if this is the main thing that we're going for, is the result is actually, ironically, an unhappy adult. I know people who were pushed so hard in school and got all of the tutors and took all of the AP classes and all of the College Credit Plus, that now they just don't like learning. And they don't even like reading anymore because they had to do so much schoolwork. I know people who were in sports so much in middle school and high school that they hate exercise now. Or even if they like exercise, they refuse to play the sport that they played all the time when they were in middle school and high school. Now, again, this is not a black and white thing. I want my kids to do well in school. My kids have played sports. But what we need to realize is it's not just us that have the temptation to push them to be the best, that they're going to have teachers and coaches who are going to tell them, you could be really good. Now, my daughter is one of the top students at Centennial High School. And what she's been told is, you could go to an Ivy League college if you just take harder classes, if you spend more time studying. And I, as a parent, feel like it's my responsibility to tell her, first of all, one, you're a top student at Centennial, all right? That's a great high school for Columbus Public. But also, there's top students at top high schools in the country who still can't get into an Ivy League school. Because what have Ivy League schools done? They've recruited even more people to apply so that they can reject as many people as possible. And so there are students from all over the country who are applying to Ivy League schools who have like a 4.95 out of a 4-point system, and they're still getting cut. Because I was reading about one board of admissions who looked at one application, and they were like, that student looks like they're trying too hard, and they cut them. So is there anything wrong with Ivy League schools? No. Am I pushing my kids to go there? No, because they're really freaking expensive is the other problem. But even if she's the top student, that doesn't mean she's going to get what she wants. But two, is my goal for her to go to a very prestigious university? Or is my goal for her to be a lifelong learner who loves the word of God, who wants to see God's name glorified? We have to think bigger picture than this. Success in sports. I don't know if you guys heard about this. There was an Olympian getting ready to go to the Olympics. I want to say what sport he was in, but I'm afraid of saying the wrong one. He injured his finger about a month ago. Was it male field hockey or regular hockey? Yeah. If he got the surgery to fix his finger, he would have missed the Olympics. So you know what he did? He amputated that part of his finger. True story. Is that what I want my kids to do to succeed in sports? No. And in fact, when you hear about the Olympians, I admire those people. Those people are so talented and they're so dedicated. But I've heard too many stories about parents who have to uproot their kid from one town to another town to put them in with that one coach. And then they have to get private tutoring because they're spending 8 hours a day in the pool or in the gym. And again, these are the extremes. But I just know too many people who either their parents pushed them into that stuff or their parents didn't help them set up limits and help them resist what the world system was offering them. And most people that I know don't play sports in college, or even if they do, they really struggle if they're playing a significant role to have any sort of involvement in the things of God. And I just want balance for my kids is what I want. I want them to love learning. I want them to love having fun. I want them to love being on a team. All of those things are valuable, and anything beyond that could interfere with the things of God. And so what do we need to do? What do we need to build in now? We need to build in a value for God's kingdom, that this is going to be what true success is the ability to serve God and to serve others, to have good relationships. You think about what Jesus says in Matthew 6, you seek first his kingdom, that I'm not trying to build myself up in my success, that I'm trying to build up God's kingdom. And then it's not just his kingdom that we seek, but we seek it first, that that's what comes first in our lives, in our schedules. You know, even recently, my son went and talked to his soccer coach. He's going to play JV. And he told the coach, you know, some varsity games are Tuesday nights, but I've got a Bible study that's really important to me. Is it okay if I leave? And we were prepared for the coach to say no. And he might have missed, you know, 5 or 6 high school central teachings. But instead, the coach was like, oh, yeah, that's fine. I was like, well, that was easy. And yet it was still a step of faith for my son to ask that. And that might not make him as popular with some of the varsity players, but he will get to go to teachings Tuesday nights, and that was more important to him, and I was really proud of him for having that value. So, want to talk very briefly about what the underlying issue is that drives our desire to pursue lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, boastful pride of life. And I really believe that the underlying issue is anxiety. That I have anxiety for my kids. Is their life going to work out? Are they going to be okay? But I also have anxiety about my parenting. What are other parents going to think? How am I going to compare to other parents as they're pushing these kids in these areas? And I'm not. I'm the one holding back. Years ago, I read that book, Free Range Kids. And that was so helpful for me because she goes into all the stats as to what actually works and what doesn't, and how dangerous the world actually is. It turns out it's not that dangerous. And you could just let your kids roam, and you can let your kids have some freedom. And I was so persuaded by it, and I still had a hard time doing it because I was afraid. Like, you remember when you were younger, if your mom took you on an errand, you could go into the store with her, or you could sit in the car. And I would sit in the car, and I would read my book, and that's what I wanted to do. I was afraid to do that when my kids were little because what if someone called the police? And so this idea that we just have to do what everybody else is doing, otherwise we might get in trouble or somebody might think something of us, it's real. It's very real. And so I just wanted to give some big picture ideas to wrap up, things to keep in mind as we're trying to resist the world system. Big picture number one, my child belongs to God. He's not mine. She's not mine. I love them, but they are not mine. Andrew Murray's book, Raising Your Children for Christ, excellent, excellent biblical book. And he just comes right out and says it. He says, your child belongs to God. God looks upon my child as his, and my child has only been loaned to me to train. The child is indeed not mine, but the Lord's. And I need to keep that in mind so that I'm seeking out what God values and not just going with what comes naturally to me. Murray goes on, he says, I love my Lord and have often asked what I can render to him for his love to me. I delight to give what is my most precious possession upon earth to be his. I love God. I want to give God good things. It says, to him who gave his son for me, to him alone, all I am and have belongs. My child, too, I have given to the Lord as long as he shall live. I mean, what more precious possession do I have than to offer my kids to the Lord and to say, God, these are yours to use as you see fit, and I want them to live for you. And so my child belongs to God. I do not have the right to determine what should and shouldn't happen. That belongs to God as well. But here's the thing. God has good plans for my kid. God is a God who loves us, who desires to see good things for us. And if that's true for me, wouldn't it also be true for my kid? Murray goes on. He says, it's not only for God's sake, but also for my child's sake that I give him to the Lord. The more I love my child, the more heartily I give him away to God. Nowhere can he be safe or happy except with him. To think that I can give my kids what they need is short-sighted, and actually the best thing that I can do for them is to entrust them to the Lord and to raise them according to the Lord's values, because that's where true safety and true happiness comes from. So having those as deep bedrock foundational beliefs are important, but then just big picture for us as parents, we all need community in order to be able to do this. That I cannot resist the pull of the world system on my own, that I need support in that. And Haidt talks about that. He says, when adults step away from each other's children and stop helping each other raise children, parents find themselves on their own. Parenting becomes harder, more fear-ridden, and more time-consuming, especially for women. So this idea that we're completely overwhelmed by parenting is super hard. That's the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. But we make it even harder on ourselves when we're not doing it in relationship with other people, when we're not getting support from each other, when we're not offering, you know, that underlying ability to withstand and to do the right thing. We need each other to be able to do that. And so we all need community. I need the support. If I'm trying to stand against the world system on my own, I am dead in the water because I'm going to feel like, what am I doing? Am I crazy? But if you can get just one other crazy person to do it with you, then you'll feel like this is worth it. Also, to be able to look to a few people who are just a little bit further ahead and see how their kids are doing, and to realize it's the people who are resisting the world system who have the happiest, most well-rounded kids is really helpful. There were many moms that I looked to that I was like, okay, I'm not going to do it exactly their way, but I'm at least going to have the same values as them. And I look at how their kids turned out, and that's what I want. But also, my kids need friends, and they need mentors. They need other people involved in their lives. Jonathan Haidt says, what young children need is a lot of time to interact with you, with other loving adults, with other kids, and with the real world. Now, when my kids got up into high school group, other people started mentoring them. I met with my daughter and my husband met with my son in middle school group, but we also added somebody else into that time. But it's so funny watching them be mentored by other people now, because I still meet with each of my kids every single week. I get regular time with them. And yet there are things that I encourage my daughter to do that when I was mentoring her or discipling her, she was like, nah, because I was her mom. And now that she's meeting with somebody else, who actually is pretty young and not a very experienced discipler at all. But this other woman will tell my daughter to do something and she'll be like, that's a really good idea. And I'm like, I've been telling you that for 17 years, but okay, go for it. And that's the way that it's supposed to be. That's actually normal and natural and healthy. And so for our kids to be tied in with other people, including other adults, but also other kids, is actually really, really necessary for them. So we all need community. And also, finally, we don't need to be afraid. We look at what the world is like, and I've heard people say, how could you ever bring children into a world like this? Well, that's not something that we need to fear, because we have the Lord, In fact, earlier on, Jesus says, I've told you these things so that you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. Yes, it's a huge system that's set up against us, but Jesus himself has overcome it. Yes, a time is coming where we won't have to worry about it anymore, but in the meantime, this is something that we have a chance to stand against because Jesus himself has overcome it already, and God will give us what we need. We need the grace of God. We need the guidance of God. We need the power of God, which he's made available to us through his son. And God says that because we have that available, that we will be able to live effectively. So in conclusion, people can tell that something isn't working. There's more and more books out there about the problem with young adults today. And here's the thing, we have the chance to raise kids differently. We have the chance to do something different. We don't have to do what everybody else is doing. And what's cool about this is it'll be better for our kids. They're going to be happier now, and they're also going to be more likely to succeed as adults if we're raising them according to what God says is important. But maybe even cooler than that, as much as this is good for them, this will also be what glorifies God. As the Apostle Paul says in the book of Philippians, if we live according to God's truth, we will prove ourselves to be children of God that shine like stars. Is it a scary time to have kids? Yes. Why? Because it's a dark time. But the darker it is, the brighter those stars shine. And so we have a chance to put forward a way of life that if it's according to God's way, people are going to look at that and wonder, what's different about that? And we'll have the chance to tell them about the grace and the guidance of God. And in the process of doing so, both we and our kids will be able to glorify him. So that's what I have on being not of this world. Lord, we are grateful for the kids that you have entrusted to us. We're grateful for the privilege of being able to raise kids according to your word. And Lord, we do want to resist the power of the world system so that we're able to raise kids according to what you say is important. Thanks that we have the chance to do that. Thanks, too, that we're under grace for this, that it's not about getting it perfect. It's just about trying to stay on the right trajectory. And Lord, I pray that you would bless us in our parenting so that we are able to present kids who love you, who love other people, who are able to be real workers and servants for your kingdom. Thanks that by the power and grace of the Holy Spirit, we have the chance to do this. Amen.